Unpack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. It's the Top Chef Judges Roundtable podcast here on Reality TV for half-ups. Hey, everyone. Mike Bloom here. We've made it. Restaurant Wars of Season 15. I will not prepare a song and dance, but we were all expecting it. And here it is, and here's the podcast to talk about Restaurant Wars. First, let me bring in our requisite Top Chef podcaster. She's been here week in and week out. We'll have a nice game this week, as per usual, of what did Haley Strong not see in the Canadian edit of Top Chef this week?
Apparently there was, like, a musical number.
No, there was not a musical number. I think Kurt was just joking.
Okay. Well, you guys, that's rude. I, as a lowly Canadian, would never pull that ass on you guys.
Well, that's because that's the stereotype, right? Or you tried to disprove that stereotype that Canadians are too nice in the very beginning. You mentioned Kurt Clark. Unfortunately, due to scheduling difficulties, Kurt was not able to make it in for this podcast. Though I personally think it's because he was so offended by Claudette shading vanilla Top Chefs that he just decided to quit the podcast. But we have a very, very special guest in his place. He unfortunately was not able to make it to Restaurant Wars in his season, but he is a Top Chef historian, knows everything about every iteration of Restaurant Wars, so we would be remiss not to bring him on in any way, shape, or form. Top Chef Charleston contestant Jim Smith. Jim, how you doing?
I am great. I am so happy to be here. It's to be on the Rob Has a Podcast feed, really, it makes my day. I'm so excited. I don't know if y'all know, but I don't have a staff here, really, and so oftentimes I'm in the kitchen for 5 or 6 hours all by myself, every day. And so I oftentimes just turn on the Rob Has a Podcast feed and go. I listen to tons of y'all, and I am super excited to be on here today.
This is so much sucking kneecaps from the beginning, but I am here for it. That's so exciting, Jim. I know we can probably squeeze in some talk, maybe at the end. I know you said you're a big Survivor fan. Are there any other, shows that you watch that we cover here on the Rahap Network?
Lots of them. In all seriousness, I'm one of those guys who is willing to admit that because my wife loves The Bachelor and Bachelorette so much that I totally get into it, and I definitely listen to the podcast. I'm a giant Big Brother fan as well. I love hearing Rob talk about the new Star Trek show. So there's lots of it. I'm in for it. And really, one of the highlights of my year was hearing Rourke mention my name on the beaches of Fiji. It really I was jumping up and down, running around the kitchen. Reached out to Rourke. She and I are Twitter buddies now, and I love it.
This is truly crazy. I'm smiling from ear to ear just hearing this. Like, everything is truly connected in the Rob Has a Podcast universe. I am so excited to have you on.
Rourke mentioned my name on that beach too, Jim's air high five.
There you go. No doubt.
So Jim, after, I would love to hear, what life post Top Chef has been for you since, you graced our screens 1 year ago. How has life been for you since?
Life has been awesome. I'm still the executive chef of the state of Alabama. I'm the chairman of the Alabama Seafood Marketing Commission. Those things are still really important to me, getting to be a representative for Alabama food. But, one of the greatest things is, I get to travel a lot more. I get to go to a lot more events. I'm actually doing an event with Bruce and Carrie in a couple of months. But, there's nothing, it is really cool. I feel humbled to be, like the last time, anytime I'm in any airport, whether it's, Philadelphia or LAX or Atlanta, people stop me and, just say how much they love seeing me, or if I'm in the line at the grocery store. And so, having that connection, being able for people to see my food and who I am on TV, has really meant a lot to me. And it's something that people don't get to come to the governor's mansion unless they get an invitation. So they don't really get to eat my food unless you have some reason to be, having luncheon with the governor. It's meant so much for me to people to get to know me and get to know the food. And I think it's the people at Top Chef, I have to thank them. Every time I talk to any of the producers or see anybody related to the show, like, they have done so much for me. And, Top Chef has changed my life like it does for so many people. And I'm just glad to be a part of that family.
Mm-hmm. I'm so interested to hear, because you were just on, the season before this one. Is there sort of like a Top Chef alumni network in a way? I know that you just said you're going to go on the road with Bruce and Carrie for a bit, but, when the season came out, did you reach out to them? Is there like a big old, I don't know, Facebook group that you guys are a part of to interact with one another?
We don't have like a secret Survivor alum Facebook group, but we do. I will say that almost virtually everybody who was on Charleston, we all are in a group chat together, and there are thousands of messages every day. But yeah, you know, I've known people from previous seasons, and as soon as the cast list came out, I pretty much liked, followed, and friended everybody on there. And it's cool to follow them online, see what's going on. But yeah, you know, there's definitely sort of a connection that we all have after going through a show like that together.
Mm-hmm. And since you're going on the road with Bruce, I have to ask, have you met Bruce before? How do you know Bruce? Because it seems like if you're a chef, you are connected with Bruce in some sort of way, shape, or form.
You know, I may be a little bit of the oddity. I have never met Bruce face to face. We are Ooh. Facebook friends, and he does seem to like and respond to various of my social media. So I'm excited to meet Bruce. Like I say, we are doing an event together in Delaware coming up in a couple months.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am also happy to say that I am joining, I guess, the knowledge level of the chef community, and we can probably talk about this later on, but I got to meet Bruce this past week. I was very fortunate. There was an event that the Three Bears, Tyler, Chef Joe Flam, and Bruce did at the James Beard House, and I was very, very lucky enough to get invited to. We dug into a sumptuous course that was totally worth the hangover the next morning. It was an incredible meal that I'm sure we can touch upon. But yeah, now I can, I guess, count myself in the realm of, you know, 95% of the cooking community. Let's sort of segue into this season proper. Jim, up to this point, what have you thought about Top Chef Colorado so far? Again, this is the first season since you have been a Top Chef alum. Are you watching it with a different pair of glasses right now besides the one that you currently own? Are you saying like, oh, I would have done this thing differently, or oh, this reminds me of when I was doing this?
Yeah, it's I mean, once you've done it, it's really, you understand more what they're going through. You understand the time constraints of it all. I mean, it is always a pressure cooker and to be on Top Chef, but I've definitely seen it with a new eyes. I'm really enjoying this season. I think all the chefs are super talented, and you know, I can't wait to meet all of them. But yeah, there's no way to, like, once you've done it, you can't separate it out and just become like a fan like I used to be.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been watching Top Chef? Again, you came on really touting yourself as a super fan. Had you been watching since the beginning?
Yes, I have watched it since the beginning. And actually, those early seasons of Top Chef really encouraged me to go to culinary school. Like, I had worked in restaurants forever before Top Chef had started airing, but I watched those early seasons, and really people who were on my season, like Sam, were such a huge motivation for me to go to, you know, to be like, I can do this. I can do what those guys are doing. And, Casey, you know, those people who were in those early seasons, it really meant a lot to me in my career. And, absolutely Tom and Gail and Padma, they have really, they gave me lots of encouragement, just by watching them on television. Oh, I was going to say also that, you know, in part of my preparation for Top Chef, I went back and did a complete rewatch of every season, which is a big, and took notes on every episode. And it really helped me a lot. And, you know, Top Chef, you know, you might not think of a show that you can do a rewatch of, but I thought the rewatch was awesome. Like, I really loved going back to those early seasons.
Would you advise future chef testants do that?
Yes. I have never heard of any chef testants doing as much preparation for the show as I did. And I know that that's really a super nerdy thing to do. And my job actually allows me space and time to do things like that. But yeah, I think you're crazy not to go back and rewatch.
And I think you're actually in the same boat as Haley, because I know that Haley had been rewatching a bunch of seasons for the first time piecemeal over the course of the past year. So you guys have much more of a short-term memory about these things than I might, which is exciting, because this is now our 15th iteration of Restaurant War. So I'm sure we can call upon many iterations in the past, much like they actually did this episode. I don't know, Haley, was this the most meta episode of Restaurant Wars we've seen?
Possibly. It was very like, oh, this is exactly what Padma's going to say when she's going to say it. Like, oh, let's just all gear up for Restaurant Wars and blah, blah, blah. So it was pretty funny in that way.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting point because, as you said, they essentially start this episode after all the aftermath from the Tanya and Claudette stuff. Speaking of which, shameless plug here. It took a little while, but I was able to sit down with Tanya to talk about essentially her side of the stuff that happened with Claudette last episode. Give it a read. It's on parade.com right now. You know, again, I might not necessarily agree with why she said what she said, but it's good to at least see where she was coming from. So be sure to check that out. But they move on to slightly lighter things in the form of restaurant wars. But as you said, Haley, I mean, they even outline it here. Okay, there's 8 chefs left. We're walking into an empty restaurant. Jim, do you feel like, is it bad for the show that the chefs are no longer surprised by it? Or do you think by actually tampering with the internal mechanics of restaurant wars rather than the timing, that's enough to keep them on their toes?
Yeah, I think it's always enough to keep them on their toes. And I think, I mean, it is a lot like the Merge and Survivor where, you know, you know what's coming. You know, it may be 8, it may be 10, but, you know, when you get there, you've reached a milestone in the show. And I don't think it makes it dull. And I do think that there were some, things that they were done differently this year. Like, I don't think it's ever been done where the chefs can sort of set the reservation book and say, okay, at 6 o'clock, we're going to have 2 tables come in. And it really seemed like the chefs had the opportunity to control when tables were seated this season, which is something I don't think they've ever done before, which is something that restaurant folks think about all the time.
How did you feel about the twist for them this time around? As they said, you know, they come into the restaurant, they meet Eric and Bruce Bromberg, which are co-owners of Blue Ribbon, big restaurateurs, and they provide the escalating twist that this time they're going to prepare 3 courses with 3 options per course for a total of 9 dishes. How difficult is it as a Top Chef contestant to, you know, get the orders to prepare multiple dishes for a challenge?
Oh, it's super tough. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's incredibly hard. And, you know, what do y'all think? Do you think that this Restaurant Wars is more hard than the lunch and dinner service of season 13?
Yeah, see, that's something I was thinking about. I would want to say that the lunch service is harder. I can't remember how many dishes were in that compared to, like, you know, if that was more dishes overall, plus over a longer span of time. And then in that one, didn't they also have to switch roles at a certain point? So everyone was kind of in the hot seat.
Yes, they had to switch roles. And I think they had to do with, like, a lunch specific thing. Like, maybe they had to have a sandwich. They had to have something that was more lunch specific. But I think they could have some overlap between the lunch options and the dinner options.
Yeah, I think that was harder. But I'm not totally a fan of trying to make it more difficult for the sake of difficulty.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard enough as it is. You know, even if they only had to do 1 dish apiece, it's still incredibly hard.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, again, this is, again, a way to sort of tamper with the internal mechanics rather than saying, because they've only, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, Jim, I believe they've only not done it at 8 twice. They did it, I think, at 6 during season 4 because they did the wedding wars at 8. And then in season 11, they did it at 10. So they, you know, it's something that you can always really look forward to. So they really need to throw them on their toes in different ways. I mean, I think the season 13 example, I feel like that was a lot more endurance just because, I mean, instead of 1 big service, you're doing something that essentially lasts, you know, 7 or 8 hours. But what I did like about that is that someone always had to be either EC or front of house, which we'll even get this episode. There's also sort of a connotation that comes with restaurant wars, which is actually incorrect, even though Claudette outlines it here of like, oh, if a team loses, either the executive chef or the front of house person goes home, which, again, is not always the case. But at least what season 13 was able to do was to say there's nowhere to hide. You're going to get some responsibility no matter what.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And more times than not, though, it is either the person in charge or the front of the house person that ends up in trouble.
So we draw knives here. Chris and Carrie are team captains. So Carrie ends up picking Bruce. Chris ends up picking Mustache Joe. Carrie picks Clean Shaven Joe. I'm here for, I don't know if you agree, Haley, I'm here for all the random nicknames that the judges are giving Joe Flam. Nothing has seemed to stick yet.
Poor Second Joe.
Yeah, big Joe, Babyface Joe, like nothing. I mean, it sticks because you would think in any other context that one of them would be eliminated at this point, but they're both such good chefs that it might be the Joe Down throwdown, as was alluded to in episode 1. We might get like a la American Idol 7, the showdown of the Davids. So, you know, Joe would never be able to escape being regarded as the other Joe. But Carrie picks Adrian, and then, or Chris picks Fatima. Carrie picks Adrian, leaving Claudette to go to Chris's team. Haley, at first blush here, did you have any sort of pick of which team would do well just at first glance?
I thought that both teams were fairly evenly matched, but based on editing and, you know, the teams kind of not really wanting to work with Claudette based on what had happened in the previous challenge, it made me believe that probably Carrie's team was going to do a little bit better. But I feel like they kept it pretty even throughout most of the episode. And it wasn't until the judges got to the table, that's when you're like, oh, okay, so this is the team that's going down, and they're going down hard.
Yeah, it's an interesting trope that we've seen very recently in Restaurant Wars, at least in my opinion. I don't know, Jim, can you think of the last truly quote-unquote competitive Restaurant Wars? Because I've been looking back, you know, last season had all the John and Katsuji stuff. The season before had Philip and Jeremy's team really tanking. The season before that had, you know, all the kerfuffle with Carrie Ann being at the front of house and Katsuji screwing up her dessert. I've been remiss to think of the last time that it really felt like Restaurant Wars was going to be up in the air by the time the judges announced the winners.
Yeah, I don't know. It does always seem to be very clear. Well, what really struck me about this one is how much Joe Stash thought that they had crushed it. You know what I mean? Like, this team had no idea. This team had no idea that they were, it was a beatdown. You know, they thought it was close. Like, even when they were announced, Padma was like, and it's a unanimous vote. Like, it looked to me like they thought that they still could win it. You know what I mean? Like,
but they didn't have any major problems during service, or like, you know, they didn't have any major blowouts with each other. They didn't have anything go like spectacularly wrong. I don't think he had any reason to believe that he might not be on the winning team. I think if anyone on that team did, it would have been Fatima, because she was out in the dining room. She saw that things were getting a little backed up. She saw maybe that the judges weren't as enthused about the dishes as, you know, they might like. But also, they have no idea what happened on the other side. I guess in the kitchen, they can see whether or not there's any big blowups there, but they don't know how service is going.
Mm-hmm. I did feel bad about that, because, you know, like you said, there are a lot of these times when these teams know, okay, we did not put out good service. But they seemed like, especially Joe Stash and Claudette, were like, oh, we did it, guys. We were fantastic. This is one of those rare Restaurant Wars where both teams did really, really good. Yeah. Like, oh, honey, you don't know what happened really out there. So it was kind of sad to watch. But yeah, the edit, especially as Haley mentioned, once the judges actually get to commonplace, they were very much in a common place about which team had lost at that point.
Yeah, no doubt. It's and it's just got to be crushing. You know, like it's got to be totally crushing. I think that really pretty much the only time I was on the bottom, you know, like I knew it was coming. You know, I was just, you know, keeping my fingers crossed that I would be safe. You know what I mean? And so, but just to not know that it's coming and to, you know, just be smacked with it. You know, you've got it's got to be terrifying. Hey, do y'all think that Chris nominated Claudette to be the executive chef as a strategic move?
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because, you know, as the teams start conferring together or conferring, Chris says, you know what, I think that Claudette should be the executive chef. And I think a little bit was made, as you said, Jim, of whether or not Chris did this purposefully, whether it was throwing Claudette under the bus or whether it was just him saying, I don't want to necessarily lead. Haley, what's your take on it?
I can see both sides of the coin here. Now I'm thinking about it.
I mean, what I would say personally is that, I mean, I think maybe this is me being naive. I do think that Chris is too good-hearted to really be that scheming and that plotting, considering that, like, what he eventually does of, hey, here's a sword, let me fall on it. Like, that doesn't make sense if he does really want to go after Claudette. I think it was more strategic in that, to be quite honest, what they've seen of Claudette so far is that they feel like Claudette does not work well with others. let's make her the boss so then she can give orders instead of being a sous chef and the possibility of her sort of, I don't know, mouthing off or causing any sort of discrepancies there. Jim, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that is exactly right. Like, I don't think that is too schemey or plotty in a bad way. Like, I think that if, you know, everyone knows, like, she's been kind of tough to work with. Let's just make her the boss. She can be the shot caller. And that way, if she's difficult to work with, she's going to bear a lot of the responsibility, you know, and a lot of the risk for potential to go home.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking towards team challenges, because you just spoke about it, you know, you wound up on the bottom during the Feast of the Seven Fishes challenge when you and Amanda collaborated on a dish together. As a chef, what is that feeling like on Top Chef collab? I mean, this is a little bit of a different situation. You two were collaborating on one dish as opposed to working together on like a bona fide team where you're putting out a unified concept, or at least you're supposed to, unless you're commonplace. But how difficult is that as a chef to, you know, there's the phrase too many cooks in the kitchen for a reason. Can it be tough sometimes to sort of put egos aside and work together with somebody on one unified piece of food?
Yeah, it is so hard to do that. And, you know, lots of people had trouble in that challenge. But, you know, like you, first of all, you know, being on Top Chef, you really have to trust that the other people are there for a reason. And for me, like, I knew who Amanda was. Like, she was awesome on her season. She did really well. And so when she and I were talking about the dish we were going to make, like, we are very much on the same page. Now, like if I had done it by myself, I would have executed the set of it a little bit differently. But, you know, we had to basically just divide up the task. You know, I butchered the fish and cooked off the fish. She did the set. And so it is difficult to collaborate that kind of way. But at the same time, you know, everyone there is good. And if you have a clear division of labor, it becomes obvious as, you know, who did what and who's responsible for what parts of the dish. And sometimes that makes the dish not as harmonious as it should be. But mm-hmm. at the same time, it is difficult, but it's fun too. And, you know, you have to trust your partner, and hopefully you get a partner that you do trust. And, you know, it seems to me like all the chefs have on this season have that trouble with Claudette. They just don't trust her as a partner. And I think that no matter what you do, if that's how you view your partner, it's going to show up in the food in the end. And that makes it a very risky place to be.
So perhaps it was that impetus that allowed the red team to sort of mull over what they were trying to do. And Joe Stash for a while seemed pretty adamant of, okay, we need something cohesive throughout. We need something to sort of rally ourselves around. But with four different chefs with four different styles of cuisine, they go for a type of quiz. I don't even know if it's a type of cuisine or just an aesthetic. Unexpected. Haley, you talked about how the edit was sort of leading us down a bad path for Team Commonplace. Was this what it started for you?
Yeah, I had to be like, ooh, this doesn't seem like a great idea. I've said it 500 billion times on this podcast. My idea of how to do the best on this show is just to keep things fairly simple. And the other team did that, you know, and they, you know, the judges mentioned it like, oh, this is a pretty simple menu, but they killed every dish pretty much. Where this was just commonplace was just a little uncommon, I guess you could say, in mm-hmm. their strategy.
Yeah, Jim, as someone who's watched a bunch of Restaurant Wars in the past, do you find that often the best teams are the ones that do unify behind a central concept, even if it doesn't fall necessarily in line with what everyone is used to cooking?
Yes, absolutely. As long as there's somebody who takes the reins, who can reel it in, you know, like I think that Bruce does a good job of keeping their menu Mediterranean, Italian-ish, you know, but when Fatima says, the theme is unexpected, you're like, what is that? The theme is a surprise? You know, like, what? You know, that is a terrible place to be. And even like, I don't know if y'all noticed it, but they had this chalkboard behind the host stand at the door. And it said at the top, it said a gathering of people and ideas. And then it had a bunch of like scribbled ideas underneath it, like feed your soul.
Oh, God. Yikes.
And joy. And you're like, this tells me absolutely nothing about this restaurant. You know, like, it's like if you were to say the theme of my restaurant is global cuisine, you're like, you just made the theme of your restaurant every food on the earth that people eat. That's a terrible idea. You know,
my theme is restaurant. Like, it's like, okay. Yeah.
My theme is forks. I didn't notice the word cloud going on the chalkboard.
That's such a weird idea.
I would almost compare Conifer to Commonplace with Conifer was like a jazz combo where everyone's playing a different instrument, but they're all playing the same song. Commonplace felt like, okay, let's get together a tuba and a pair of maracas and a bass drum and, you know, an out-of-tune piano where everyone's playing a different song and nobody can get on the same page. And I think, you know, while interpersonally they got along, I feel like that concept just really wasn't there. Speaking of names, Jim, how did you feel about the two names here, Commonplace and Conifer? I don't know if you remember any of the previous restaurants from other seasons, but how do they stack up?
Yeah, I think that these are, I think that these names are good. The names in and of themselves are good. I think that the only other restaurant name that I remember is that didn't the Voltaggios, weren't they on a team together, and didn't they call it Volt or something like that? Like, in my mind, that's really the only name that sticks out. Not really because that's a great name, but just because it's memorable. But yeah, I thought these names were fine. These names are like nondescript restaurant names, which is fine. At least it wasn't a blank and blank. I don't know if that's what really sort of gets to me now. Like every new restaurant in America is something and something that don't necessarily go together. Like I don't know a good example. Like
beaten chocolate.
Yes, exactly. it's usually something that's kind of hipsterish. You know, like. Maple and ivy, or, you know, like maple and mushroom, or, you know, like a butcher's block and rose. You know, it's just something that's like totally like two a blank and a blank and just don't fit together. Like I'm so ready for this restaurant naming trend to be over. So these names to me weren't really like offensive or silly or too trendy, but I thought they were good.
Wasn't one last season like biscuits or something, and then they didn't even have biscuits on the menu?
I could have seriously helped Katsuji's Southern themed restaurant. You know, and one of the names of the restaurants last year was the name of the local strip club.
Stop! So, no, it wasn't.
Yeah, I think it was something like Southern Belle.
That is something hilarious.
Something like that. Like the locals came in and were going like, you know that there's a gentleman's club here named.
Wow, that's just so outstanding. Wow.
Oh my god, I love this new trend though, as you were pointing out, Jim, because it just seems like someone walks into a kitchen, points at two random objects, and decides to name their restaurant after it. Sounds like the weirdest, laziest form of Davey things. But the only other one that I can really think of in terms of Restaurant Wars past, I remember, I think it was season 3, one of them named their restaurant The Garage, which a really, really janky name. I don't want to go, maybe if it's like, again, located in like an actual garage where someone's like, hey, you want to go check out The Garage? It sounds like some skeevy stuff is happening. But speaking towards hipster stuff, we get a little bit of a deviation from the norm in that usually the chefs, they split up and do half go food shopping, half go decor shopping. It seems like decor is being taken care of this season. Haley, what did you think about this idea that we brought in designers to confer with the chefs and they designed
and
the
not
restaurant
conifer with the chefs?
They didn't conifer. Yeah, they didn't did in this case.
I thought this was a fantastic idea. A lot of these chefs, well, I'm sure they had a finger on the pulse in the creation of their restaurants or whatever. They weren't doing the actual designing probably, and it's better to leave that to, you know, the professionals. Like, they're leaving the food to the professionals, and then this way they could come up with like a concept, talk to them, and then those people could really make the vision come to life, and the chefs could focus on the food. And I think both restaurants looked beautiful. I think that's probably the best Restaurant Wars visually that we've seen in a very long time. So I thought this was a great idea, and I hope they keep doing that.
Yeah, very beautiful bison head.
It's way more realistic too. You know, like this is how chefs go and hire designers to make sure that their restaurant interior looks great. And, you know, that kind of stuff is way more realistic than, you know, sending the chefs to the local Crate and Barrel to pick out a bunch of random decor.
Mm-hmm. Haley, is greenery the color of the year?
It was in 2017, baby. Ultraviolet is 2018.
Is there like a memo that I missed about this? How do you know these things?
It's the Pantone color of the year.
Okay, I guess I didn't sign up for their newsletter or anything. I had
Sorry,
no idea.
So it's super popular in
if you're in the interior design world or fashion world or makeup world, which I understand that you're probably not super involved in, and those are more of my areas of expertise around here. But I love to keep up with the Pantone colors of the year.
I just thought it was a joke at first that greenery is the color in Colorado year round.
No, it was the 2017 color of the year.
Yep. Wow. So interesting. So we start to segue into the actual preparation. As you mentioned before, Jim, Bruce, he knows his way around a kitchen, and he goes with the strategy of let's create dishes that are more prep intensive. Let's put more labor in the first day. So then on the second day, when the restaurant actually opens, we deal a lot better with setting these dishes out quickly, so we don't need to deal too much with the execution. How much do you think that strategy paid off for them?
I mean, immensely. And I think that that is the best articulation of a solid restaurant war strategy that I may have ever heard on the show. You know, like, let's do stuff that is easy and quick to make and service that we can knock out and it'd be good and do all the work on the front end. Like, that is the best strategy. And usually you don't hear it articulated that way on the show, but Bruce chose wisely. Like, they made smart decisions in doing it that way.
Yeah. I mean, again, going back to the editing, considering that the only major real, and I'll put hiccup in quotations because it didn't even seem like that much of a big thing in retrospect. The only thing was, oh, I thought that we wouldn't get slammed at service, but we did. Like, they did very, very well. This might be one of the best overall performances I've seen on Restaurant Wars in quite some time. And then on the other side, Hilly, let's talk about Claudette's edit here a bit, because yes, I hear the eagerness in your voice right now.
You're backing off your Claudette fandom a little bit, or?
No. I will stay strong as a stand for Claudette. But I did think this was probably her time to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, even in from an editing perspective.
Yeah, from an editing perspective, it felt very broadcasted. You know, from the other chefs kind of talking about having Claudette as a team member, from Claudette kind of saying what she was saying. We got some flashbacks to last week, and it felt very like this is what was going to happen and it was inevitable.
Well, and we also got a lot of our, you know, we coined the hashtag Claudette side eye from the very beginning, but it came back in full force this episode. I mean, right now at this point in the episode is when Claudette says, yeah, the other team is really strong, minus Adrian and Carrie. And I'm like, Adrian and Carrie have won like three more challenges total than you have, Claudette. It's like, I'm wondering, you know, was that just them picking and choosing sound bites from her? Or do you think she really has just has that sort of contempt towards some of her team, some of those other chefs?
Why not both?
Yes, I guess so.
I don't necessarily think that was a Franken edit, but she was totally ruthless. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, Chris avoids responsibility. Adrian and Carrie are boring. She called Bruce boring. She called the menu boring. She just did not hold back, you know? And I don't think that's necessarily like a producer or somebody asking questions, like getting her to that point. Like, I think that she actually, I heard an interview with her yesterday that where she says that she grew up with boys and she loves to talk smack and that people shouldn't take it so personally, that she's ruthless. And I'm glad she is. I do want to say this too. It's like, I know people who do events with her and who hang out with her, and she's totally awesome. You know, single mom, her food is awesome. Her restaurants are great. And so, I kind of like that she was just willing to, you know, to bare the teeth and to stick it to the other team, whether she's right or not. You know, I may be questionable, but, you know, go for it, Claudette.
Yeah, I think she likes to do a lot of playful trash talk. We even saw that in Last Chance Kitchen a bit. There's this one fun bit where brother's like, yeah, I'm like Rocky. And Claudette says, oh, yeah, didn't Rocky lose in the end? Like, I think she likes to talk a lot of crap, but I think maybe the way it was said in the confessional just didn't come off well. I don't know. I personally was turned off to Claudette in this episode, especially the way that things ended, which I'm sure we're going to get to. But I want to go back to this edit idea, Jim. Just going back to your season, watching things back, was there anything that surprised you about the way things were edited together, considering you were there firsthand experiencing them?
Not really, but in all seriousness, like literally on the first day, Casey saw me. I may have like rolled my eyes at something, but Casey was literally like, she put her hand over her microphone. She whispered in my ear. She said, look, don't do that. because you don't know when this will show up 3 weeks later. And I don't really think that Top Chef is a show that really tries to edit people in a specific way. I don't think that they're necessarily interested in continuing villain storylines throughout the season. I mean, really with Top Chef, the food is first, but at the same time, you don't want to give them ammunition to make you a story, right? I mean, you want your story to be your food was awesome, you know, and you control that. And I think that, you know, it takes a minute to understand that. Like, you know, some reality shows, like, they may leave your mic on when you're in the bathroom and they hear you talk smack about somebody, and that may show up as a voiceover in a different, and, you know, later on in a different episode. Top Chef, in my opinion, doesn't do that. But at the same time, you know, like, if you were going to mouth off and make fun of every other person on the show, chances are good that at least some of that's going to get used. And you probably realize that when you're saying it.
Well, speaking of someone who probably doesn't mouth off that much, Tom walks through the kitchen and talks with Chris. And Tom calls Chris out a bit for, oh, you didn't, appoint yourself executive chef, which I call a little bit of BS on Tom's part, because nowhere in the edit this episode did we get anything from Carrie's perspective, who did the exact same thing with Bruce. I'm not entirely sure what it is. Maybe Tom just has a certain image of Chris, but that confused me a bit. I think it actually might be Carrie later on who vocalized to Chris, like, just because you drew the knife out of the knife block does not make you, this is not like King Arthur days, you know, just because you pulled the sword from the stone does not mean you have to be the deigned leader of this team. But Chris decides, speaking of swords, to say, okay, if something goes wrong, it will fall on my shoulders. Haley, at this point, were you getting like Kristen Kish vibes going on?
I just want to say that I think I have some permanent knots in my back from being crunched up with anxiety during this entire episode. Like, I had like a stomach ache throughout. I was so anxious watching this.
Just because like you saw that and you're like, oh, this is it. Chris's time to go.
Like, there were so many moments where I was like, Claudette's going, Chris is going. Fatima's going, like the only one who I knew, Joe's going, like there was, everyone could have gone for a certain reason, and I was just like, maybe they'll just send the whole team home. I don't know, maybe they will.
Mm-hmm. I also want to talk briefly, because this is where we sort of get Brother's confessional, because for those of you that didn't see, because it's such a intensive version of Restaurant Wars, they got to pick two eliminated chefs to assist them as sous chefs. Commonplace Prick's Brother and Conifer picks Tyler, so the Bears are back together, much like I saw them back together earlier on this week. And again, goes back to the edit. I thought this was really interesting, Jim, that we got Brother's side of things talking about. He's like, I don't know why I'm caramelizing white chocolate. This seems like a weird menu, but I'm just going to put my head down. But nothing from Tyler about what he thinks about the meal, which again, I think really foreshadowed the mistakes that was going to end up with Commonplace.
Yeah, and you know, I think that maybe, like, if I was in Brother's position, like if I had been just like crushing it in Last Chance Kitchen, I would just go in there and keep my mouth closed and watch.
Ooh,
what
interesting tactic, Jim.
You know, in all seriousness, like I would just be spying, like what these people are doing. Yeah. Like, yeah, you want me to roast some white chocolate? I'm there for it. You know what I mean? But I would not. I think the Brother played it exactly right. You know, like you can leave with your opinions about what happened, you know, but don't put your two cents in. It's not your job to do that in this episode, you know, in this position, and then just lay low. Like, he played it so smart.
What I will say in terms of the editing on the positive side is that I did like, as you sort of mentioned before, I guess like the small redemption that comes with Commonplace, where the next day hits and they're like singing songs and throwing stuff at each other playfully and all smiles and having a good time. So it seems like maybe just because I was like, maybe I had PTSD from last season when it was just so, so uncomfortable between John and Katsuji, and I still have knots in my back from even last week when things got uncomfortable. So I was expecting the worst. So to have that happen, I was like, okay, maybe things will turn out to be okay for Commonplace, which I guess was woefully optimistic on my part, Haley.
Yeah, I'd have to say so. It's Restaurant Wars, so expect some not great thing happening.
Well, let's start off with Conifer, as the judges do as well. First, speaking towards the overall restaurant, Jim, would you say that Joe Flam did the best front of house service in Restaurant Wars history, or is that being too hyperbolic?
No, I think he did an amazing job. I think that Brooke also really crushed it. I mean, there are people, there are lots of people who are really good at it. Like if I had made it, I would have volunteered to do front of the house because I just have a lot of, I have a lot of experience doing the front of the house. And I think that every modern chef needs to be able to do that. Like when I first started working in restaurants and kitchens and really nice ones, there was this sort of attitude in the kitchen where like the chefs were too good for food TV and reality shows. And they just sort of scoffed. They would just sort of hide in the kitchen and say like, my food will do the talking for me. I don't have to be out there. It doesn't matter what I look like. But the, you know, those days are dead and gone. Like you, in order to be a chef of a successful restaurant, you have to be the face of the restaurant. You have to be out there talking to tables. You have to be able to look at a table and be like, oh, this table needs a fork and somebody over there needs to refill some wine. So, you know, like I think that chefs are starting to wake up to this realization. And, you know, Joe did an awesome job, but, you know, he said it in his restaurants, you got to go out there and talk to those people and you got to be able to look at a table and know what's wrong with it. So, yeah, he did an awesome job. Totally awesome job. Maybe perhaps the best ever.
Yeah, it's interesting because I want to segue a bit to talk about this first course. I was a little surprised that he won because, I mean, his crudo dish did not necessarily go over well. But I wonder if it's because, you know, restaurant wars can be so dicey when it comes to front of house. You know, you can get a case like what happened with Fatima where someone isn't necessarily the most comfortable with it, that when someone exceeds expectations, it really just blows the judges out of the water enough to, you know, really give them the true victory. Haley, what do you think about that?
I agree. And hospitality is a really important part of dining, in my personal opinion. Maybe that's just because I come from a hospitality background. Mm-hmm. And I was so blown away by Joe's performance. And yeah, maybe his dishes weren't the best, but he made the restaurant experience for so many people. And a lot of the times it's the experience of it rather than just like, oh, this food was great. But like you remember the restaurant based on the experience.
All right, well, let's get into this first course here at Conifer with Joe Flam's crudo. We've got Carrie's kale salad with beets three ways and Bruce's very oft mentioned polenta meatball. He decides to literally take Tom's advice and pull it out here. Jim, did any one of these three stand out to you in particular?
Oh yeah, I would eat the heck out of that meatball polenta. Italian food and Southern food have a lot of similarities. And a lot of times when you go to places like New York and LA, people are like, oh, polenta, I love it. It's so wonderful. But then when you say, I'm serving grits, people are like, ooh, what is that? But literally grits and polenta are virtually the exact same thing. So to me, like this dish bears a lot of similarities with Southern cuisine and I would eat the heck out of it.
I'd have to agree with the meatball. I'm so bored of kale, so that would get an automatic pass for me. Although I'd love to try the beets three ways.
There's like, I think that a lot of times people, top chefs and the editing and all of that, they want to show like chefs try to put something that no one's ever heard of in a dish. Like, you know, Joe did the green almonds, the neonata oil. Which are two pretty weird ingredients, but are neat to see that they made it on the menu. But yeah, the beet raisins.
Yeah, I love that. And that again is like, as I said last week, I'm starting to really understand Carrie's sort of POV now. And I feel like that's totally in line, right? She's doing these really unconventional techniques to these ingredients. And I enjoy beets. I'm probably a bigger fan of kale than Haley is, or Kaylee. I might need to call you eventually.
How dare you, Michael?
But I like that. And I think even Gail talked about this, how I think starting off with a salad, Conifer was just very cohesive. And I think that offering a salad as that first course, they were even talking in the menu planning about how, okay, you know, each course should probably be, you know, a fish, a meat, and a veg. And so I feel like Carrie did a really, really good job here. Let's segue into the second course. Joe Flam's duck breast, Bruce's pasta, and probably by far the Achilles heel of Conifer, Adrian's hot plate sea bass. Jim, do you have any thoughts about these dishes?
Yeah, I'm a giant duck fan, and you know, duck and fruit is a really classic combination. I would love to eat that dish. The red pepper orchietti sounded awesome too. I don't know if you, like I've been trying to live tweet Top Chef episodes. I really have most of the season, but people on the Twitter feed were ranting and raving about how there's no sea bass in Colorado. because, you know, they did call it Colorado striped bass, and Joe certainly called it sea bass. So I actually did, do a little bit of research on this, and that, striped bass do exist in fresh waters all over the country, but there is apparently one farm in Colorado that grows, that is farming sea bass, like striped sea bass. And I think that there's a pretty good chance that the Whole Foods does carry that product, which is sort of strange, to do a saltwater fish farmed, but it does happen. Like, I know there's a place in Alabama that does shrimp inland, you know, like freshwater shrimp inland. So things like that do happen. It's just kind of interesting to note that, you know, there are in fact striped bass in Colorado.
That's so interesting. I never even thought of a career of like, hey, we're inland. Let's make a fish hatchery. Let's farm some fish. I can only assume how much that sea bass costs, considering that, I mean, that farm literally has a monopoly on the sea bass. I didn't even think about that. The geography didn't even come to mind for me. Haley, what dishes stood out to you here?
I'm with Jim. The duck sounded amazing. I love duck. With roasted apricots sounds just like unbelievably good. And I'm a big fish fan, but they did not make that sea bass sound very appetizing. So I might have to take a pass on that.
I was going to say the description of the sea bass dish was very vague as well. You know, there was some sort of puree, which didn't appear on the list on the bottom of the screen. It may have been the pickled cauliflower that was on the dish was also pureed, but they didn't do a very good job. I'm not sure, you know, Adrienne may not have in her recipes included what the puree was when she turned her recipe in, but, you know, there was, the hot plate thing is crazy. Like,
yeah,
if you have a chef telling you this plate is too hot, you know, like chefs have asbestos hands and we grab hot plates all the time. if someone is saying, hey, your plate is too hot, like you probably should like move it off of the fire. I mean, literally she has her plate sitting above the fire where they're cooking. And, you know, you got to know that's going to cook your sauce. It's sort of like, you know, a port reduction is just going to burn if you put it on a, you know, a flaming hot plate.
It's going to keep reducing into nothing.
Yes. Yeah,
exactly. It's a permanent reduction. It's interesting, though, what you were saying about the hot plate is essentially what Adrienne was saying about seasoning a couple of episodes ago when we had Brooke on, of like, oh, if a chef says it's, you know, it's seasoned correctly, it means that it's too salty for the customers. So maybe that's the rule of hot plates as well. I also never heard the term asbestos hands before. I love that.
I will say that I think Adrienne, whatever chef gave Adrienne that device, that advice is totally off of it. You know, like chefs should not encourage diners and, you know, home cooks or whatever to underseason anything. You know, like chefs, it's our job to make people's palates understand what properly seasoned food tastes like. And, you know, I think that Adrienne probably knows that too, but that's totally sketchy advice about seasoning.
Well, let's move on to the third course here. Adrienne has a little bit of redemption as we move into dessert. Bruce makes an apple upside down cake. I was a bit confused because I thought I heard before that he said an apple bacon upside down cake. And I don't know if bacon made its way into there, but he does. I guess Bruce is like tech. He does Italian stuff and he puts bourbon on things because there's a nice apple butter bourbon glaze on the cake. Carrie does her lemon curd, sugar cookie and mint gelée. It's a take on the lemon bars that, again, the other bit of drama from Conifer was that Carrie could not get the right texture on her lemon bars. Commercial break. Okay, it's fine now. And Adrienne produces a white chocolate buttermilk cake with a creme fraiche that the judges absolutely love. Haley, you're a dessert person. Which one of these stood out to you?
The lemon curd. Ooh, I love a lemon dessert. Ooh, that's just like perfect for me. All of them sound pretty good. I'm not the biggest white chocolate fan, so maybe Adrienne's wouldn't really call to me. But would I say no to any of these dishes if they were sitting in front of me? Absolutely not. I would never do that.
What about you, Jim?
I agree completely. The lemon sounded awesome. They loved the white chocolate. I'm the same way. I am not a fan of white chocolate, and you probably never see it in my kitchen. But creme fraiche ice cream sounded totally awesome. They loved that. I will also say, whenever I hear creme fraiche, I can't help but think of that South Park episode.
Yes, same! Like,
so, I love creme fraiche. I use it all the time, but I just can't hear it or see it on TV without snickering a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad I'm not the only person. That makes me very, very happy. And now, since you're a South Park fan, I hope you did not mind when we compared you to Butters last season, Jim.
No, I did not mind at all. I didn't mind at all. And I did love whoever was responsible for that impression of me. I'm all for that.
Perfect. That is that was Josh Wigler, who also sends his love, by the way, in absentia. He misses you very much. So let's segue, you know, the judges give the very summarized view of Conifer that, you know, a couple of not so good dishes, but a solid job overall. Commonplace would really have to live up to expectations in order to, you know, beat them out. And unfortunately, they did not meet those expectations. Let's start as we did with Conifer with the overall service. Haley, what was going on here with Fatima and the servers?
So first of all, I don't think Fatima really had a game plan going into training the servers. It seemed like Joe was like, this is how your plates are done, this and this and this and this, where Fatima seemed like, okay, so like, what do you guys know about serving? And she wasn't super impressed with the level of experience that her servers had. So I think that might have thrown her for a loop a little bit. And oh, I just felt so bad. I don't know. And I'm surprised, because I would have figured that Fatima would be like really great at this role, but she just didn't kill it as much as I wanted her to.
Oh, I think that Tom really hit the nail on the head here. Like, there's a couple of strategies you can take as a restaurant manager. Like, you can be the manager who assigns people to do things, or you can be the manager who does things themselves. And so Joe was like going to the tables directly, but Fatima would be more like track down the server or tell the server to go refill wine, instead of like Joe would just go refill the wine himself.
Yeah, and it was a weird thing as well. Again, maybe this is the edit, but it seemed like Fatima had a more untrained staff than Joe. As we mentioned before, Haley, she asked, okay, who's served before? And nobody sort of raises their hand. I don't know if they got them from Colorado Central Casting or something, but, you know, you have issues where the table numbers were wrong, and, you know, I think reflects more badly on Claudette than Fatima, but somebody actually sends food back because the food actually is not hot. And so it just, and then there's a weight building as well, which is, you know, in restaurant wars, when you get those ominous shots of people, you know, sitting in the waiting area, you know that something bad's going to happen. But I also feel bad for Fatima too, in that I think when the judges came, I think she was not making things up when she said that they sort of caught her at a bad time, or she was turning tables and clearing things. And, you know, Tom definitely didn't make for a great experience starting off when he starts snickering about how he doesn't like all the high tops going on there, Haley.
What's wrong with some good Converse, Tom?
Yeah, I don't know.
He seems like the type of guy who would like roll in with his Converse and his Ray-Bans and be like, look how cool and fresh and young I am. So I don't know.
It keeps you from rolling your ankles. I know that's a problem that I had. I had like a low rolling Converse for a while, and I rolled my ankles at least like a dozen times wearing it. That's why I don't wear Converse anymore.
Oh my God. Okay. Jim, how are your ankles?
My ankles are pretty good. And I do like the Converse.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure I remember you rocking them in the kitchen at one point in time last season. So it's a good look. Maybe not such a good look from Tom's perspective. All the greenery, even though Joe Stash is a plant father, Tom is, it does not like his children. He says it just feels like a weird fern bar.
It did, like the crowd shots, even the people waiting, it did look like people were having fun, like they were drinking, and it did seem more like a bar, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it felt a lot more casual.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into this first course here on Commonplace. Fatima, since she takes front of house, she decides, you know, Joe Flam did two dishes. She does one here, this tartare, just so it can easily be done while she's preparing everything front of house. So Joe Stash does two dishes here. He does his oysters and he does the chicken purse. None of these really go over well. Haley, did any of them go over well to you?
If I had to pick one, I would probably pick the chicken purse. Tartare is not really my jam, and they said it wasn't seasoned super well. And I think that's really important when it comes to a tartare. You want that season. The spring pea foam, like, I'm not here for foods that aren't meant to be foam made into foam. Like, that's just not something I want.
Marcel is shook.
Well, keep shaking, buddy. That's just not what I want when it comes to me. And I get this oyster and it's just filled with some green goo. It's just not super up my alley.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Jim?
Yeah, I think that if I was looking at the menu, I would have ordered the oyster. Like, I love oysters. And to me, kombucha pickled rhubarb sounds totally amazing. Like, I use kombucha and vinaigrettes, but I've never pickled with it. It sounds like a great idea. And to me, like, I'm with you on foams. Like, I'm so over foam. And it's not like they're hard to make. They're really very easy to make. But to me, kombucha, rhubarb, and pea and oyster sounds like a great flavor combination. But, you know, if you don't taste the pea, if the foam is so light and airy that you don't get any flavor, that's, you know, it's just a garnish at that point and a bad garnish at that point. And so, you know, me, like, I think a pureed sweet pea and some crunchy rhubarb that's pickled would have been totally awesome in that dish.
Yeah, Joe's dish to me was a nice representative of my night at the Bear House, because they did serve some oysters as an appetizer. It was an oyster with a sherry maple cream that was delicious. And I also drank some kombucha the next morning to deal with my horrible hangover from having about a bottle of wine that night. So it was all connected. The chicken purse sounded really interesting, but it seemed like a rare slip up with pasta from Joe here, and that it seemed like the pasta was too firm and it didn't steam long enough. I felt like for a second, like you said, Haley, I'm totally in agreement that I felt like at least three out of the four of them could have gone. I still don't know if they would have gotten rid of Chris, especially we'll talk about it considering what has happened in Restaurant Wars past when people have done that. But Fatima, I was getting a little fearful that we get a Carrie Ann-like moment where, you know, they burn the chips. They didn't really prepare the meal maybe to her liking and she would suffer as a result because that was her only dish. Did you feel the same thing, Haley?
Yeah, that was another reason where I was getting real nervous for Fatima.
All right, well, let's move on to the second course here. We have Claudette's bone marrow, or is it bone marrow? Because no one can really taste the bone marrow with the prawns. Joe Stash goes for a ricotta dumpling, and Chris goes for the braised pork shoulder and cheek. Jim, what stood out to you here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, if I was ordering off the menu, and there's no doubt in my mind, I would have picked Claudette's, blue prawns, bone marrow, avocado puree, tomatillo, chilies, and peanuts sounds completely awesome to me. That sounds like great flavors. I'm sure Chris's dish, is much more in line with the cooking that I do. Like I'm familiar with that. But to me, Claudette's is what I would have ordered in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Haley?
I would probably be between Claudette's and MJ. Who's MJ?
Mustache Joe.
Oh, Mustache Joe. I was like, okay. I'm reading off Kurt's notes and MJ. I'm like, what the shit is MJ?
They brought them in through Last Chance Kitchen.
Ricotta, I'm so in on. I love ricotta, anything with mushrooms and tried broccoli and broccoli. Oh, that sounds just super delicious. I know it didn't turn out super awesome, but I probably, gun to my head, I would have ordered the dumplings.
Yeah, I probably would have as well. That sounded really good, especially the mushrooms and the charred broccoli. I would have gone for Chris's, actually, especially since they said it was salty, because I really love salty things. So I would not have minded it.
How salty does it have to be for Tom to say it's salty?
That's true. Exactly. Actually, Tom was feeling pretty salty about how salty it was. That's how salty it ended up being. So we, as the judges are still ruminating over exactly what commonplace is all about, we move into the third course here, dessert. Chris does the, as I alluded to before, a beet donut with a chocolate ganache. Claudette goes for a sundae with a financiere and a berry sauce. And Claudette also does is a skyr, is that how you pronounce it, with the miso chickpeas? Haley, again, going to you as our dessert correspondent. Which one stood out to you here?
I think I would go for the beet donut. I love a savory sweet dessert. So the beet donut with the chocolate cream and beet fennel chutney. Sorry, Kurt.
Maybe that's another reason why he didn't come on the podcast.
Probably. That sounds like something I would want. Yeah, the other one's like sundae. Okay, cool.
Sundae to me just felt like something they had to, like, oh crap, we need a ninth dish. Oh sure, I'll make an ice cream sundae. I can understand what they were going for, especially with making the ice cream, but as Tom seemed to allude to, it seemed like the ice cream was overspun and so it was a little grainy. I feel like Chris and Carrie could go into a beet restaurant together. Jim, they can call it Beet and Beet.
Oh, there you go. think Tom is right. Like, I probably would have gone for the beets too, but you know, it stinks that they said it didn't taste like beet. Like, I think that, like, maybe if he had, instead of holding the donuts, left it, a donut to be stuffed with his, with the beet chutney, it would have been an awesome call. Like Tom said, you know, make a beet jelly and, you know, stuff a donut with it. I think that's would have been completely awesome. Padma didn't like the chocolate on that. But yeah, I don't even think that they said what flavor the ice cream was that was overspun. Like I went back and relooked at it and I don't think anybody did, but I don't know. Skyr pudding sounds kind of good. You know, that's like a yogurt pudding. Sounds pretty sweet. They also, like, I've got to say, this has got to be the most desserts ever we've seen in a Top Chef episode. Yeah. I mean, maybe there was a dessert challenge at some point, but for the most part, these desserts were done pretty well. Almost all of them.
Gail was happy. She misses Top Chef desserts so much. Little known spinoff. Restaurant Wars is done, but judging still happens. I know we spoke about, you know, Joe's win before. I did like Padma's moment here where she misattributes the quote, "People come to a restaurant for the food, but they stay for the hospitality," to Danny Meyer. And it turns out that the person that actually said it was sitting right next to her. I thought it was such a funny moment, Haley.
That it was just killer. Oh, my God. And I love Salty Tom.
And he was feeling real salty about after Chris's pork cheek. So Joe Flam takes it here. It's Joe's, he won the $5,000 and the mise en place challenge back in episode 2. But this is the first time that Joe has won an elimination challenge proper. Jim, we've been talking on the podcast about how we do feel like this is a pretty wide open field, more so than usual. You know, of the 7 that are left, everyone has won a challenge except for Fatima. Do you agree? Do you feel like, especially with Joe's win here in Restaurant Wars, that pretty much anyone can take it at this point?
Yeah, I feel like it's completely wide open. And I think you could even see people who are maybe at the bottom, like Adrian, maybe could charge ahead and make a huge comeback. Fatima too. I still think that Fatima really isn't showing the food that she makes, even still. Like, the tartare didn't seem to have anything to do with her point of view. So, yeah, I mean, I think that anybody has a chance to win it and to make it to finals. I mean, it's going to be a really close season.
Mm-hmm. So we get to Commonplace coming in front of the judges. All right, let's talk about this.
Can we just skip it?
No, we can't skip it. Unfortunately not, because we did talk about this last week, this ominous shot of Chicago Joe talking to Adrian and saying, like, hey, what she's saying about Tanya is the same thing that she sort of said about you when you were on the bottom. And there's this idea that was sort of perpetuated about how Claudette, you know, will try to maybe spin things a different way in order to save herself. It seemed to really come out here where she says, you know, yes, I was the executive chef, but Chris was technically the leader. I was just the expediter. And the judges, I will give the judges props for calling her out on this directly, but I mean, Haley, what were your feelings towards how Claudette was sort of handling the fallout from their loss?
So I think she had a point in her dish with Adrian. I think she had a point last week with Tanya. I don't think she was correct in her point this week just because Chris pulled the knife. I don't think that I agree with Carrie. It doesn't mean he has to be the leader. And Claudette made some mistakes. She didn't taste every dish. She didn't do this. She didn't do that. And I think she was trying to grasp at straws to save herself. She was already gone out. She didn't want to go out again. So I understand where she's coming from. I've been that person where I'm trying to be like, well, this and this wasn't my fault. So blah, blah, blah. But it was just kind of like, it was very cringeworthy. And I was in my head, I was like, don't say it, Claudette, don't say it, don't say it. And then she said, I'm like, fuck.
Yeah, Jim, we didn't talk about Claudette's sort of leadership style. She throws shade on Bruce for, oh, Bruce is too, you know, hands-on, he's trying too much. She was very much about, everyone should just stand on their own 2 feet, and I want everyone to be happy. Looking back in retrospect, is that the worst choice you can make as an executive chef in terms of leadership style?
Generally, yes. But on the show, I don't necessarily blame her before. And in fact, we've seen situations on Top Chef where, you know, Tom comes around and says, who's the leader? And people say nobody. That usually doesn't work, but sometimes it does. And I would understand how it's got to be hard for Claudette to critique someone's dish, a competitor's dish, as they're being served. But if you know something's wrong and you don't correct it, then that's just increasing the chances that you'll be on the bottom. You know, I think really, I think the judges were probably having a hard time who to send home until I think one of the top chef kisses of death is, you know, did you not taste everything? No. I mean, that is almost a guarantee that you're done for. And I'm not so sure that it was Claudette's responsibility. I mean, she was the executive chef. She was the expediter. So yes, it was her responsibility. But at the same time, you know, are you going to tell your people who you're competing against that something's wrong with their dish? I mean, I guess you have to, but I understand how it's hard for her. I mean, she could have said, you know, you're top chef. You're here for a reason. You take responsibility and ownership for your dish, like happens in every other episode. That's your deal. I'm just going to make sure that its service runs smoothly. I mean, I understand where she's coming from.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'll admit that initially I thought that Joe Stash was going to go just because he cooked three dishes and none of them went over well. But then, like you mentioned, when Claudette said that, I thought, okay, you know, this is Claudette's time. She's going. But then Chris decides
to... Yeah, it was like, whoa, Chris, what the shit are you doing?
Chris decides to step forward and say, you know, like I mentioned before, this all falls on my shoulders. And it was so interesting because I feel like for the first time you had both fellow chef testants and the judges actually, like, I wouldn't say taking his side, but speaking up and saying, like, no, stop doing that. It's okay. You know, it's you gave Claudette the responsibility and she accepted it. I don't know. Part of me thinks that after the Josie Kristen Kish, you know, controversy in season 10, I don't know if the judges will sort of make that thing happen again. I don't know. Jim, what did you feel about this whole Chris stuff?
I mean, I think he was too quick to take responsibility for something that wasn't his responsibility. It's not like he said, Claudette, you're the executive chef. That's the decision. They had a discussion about it. Like, they came to an agreement as to who the executive chef was going to be. And so I think he was just a little too fast. I mean, it's like you said, he's such a nice guy. He probably felt responsible for suggesting that Claudette be the exec. But at the same time, she said yes. Everybody agreed to it. So I think he was a little too fast. Like, I'm glad Padma just said, do you want to go? Because it almost sounded like he was just, you know, giving up, which I don't think he was, but it would be easy to understand how the judges might think that, okay, he's volunteering to go home. And that's, you never want to do that.
Yeah. And Haley, I want to give major kudos to Fatima as well, because she was the one on the chef's side to really speak up and say, you know, Chris has a lot of integrity and he really wants to take everything to heart. So please, judges, essentially don't take his word at face value.
Very true. Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, that stew room was really awkward too. Like, it was very clear, like, it's everyone against Claudette. I felt bad for her. And, you know, part of it is of her own making, no doubt, but I still felt bad for her. I mean, yeah, you know,
I felt bad to her for a certain extent, but then she gets into the stew room and she continues to spin things by being like, well, I didn't want to do this in the first place. And Fatima's like, what are you talking about? So I totally agree with you both that, you know, I see where Claudette's coming from. And I feel like, you know, when you're backed into a corner, you want to try to defend yourself. But at the same time, it just felt like it just felt like it was done in futility. And there was so much working against her that any sort of attempt she made just sort of came off as ridiculous. And so when it culminates here in Claudette being eliminated once more, it's been tough. I can't remember a more awkward exit. Even Tanya last week, who, again, had some very strong emotions connected to her exit, seemed very cordial when she left.
This was so Fifi O'Hara in All Stars 2.
Yes, not or Cody in when he got eliminated the second time in the most recent season of Big Brother. Just like no hugs, no goodbyes. Just it seemed like Claudette almost just like walked off the set.
I think that's exactly what happened. I was just gonna say you see a little bit of Padma hair flip, side eye. You know, like I think that was just probably confirmation that they all made the right decision. Watching her storm off.
Yeah, and we get a little bit of vocalization of that attitude in the confessional where, you know, Claudette says, the judges were wrong, I stuck to my flavors and my guns, and this is, you know, again, she sort of got my goat during a few times this past episode, but this is what really did it for me, was her saying, you know, essentially inferring, like, I have the best story, you know, I'm the most entertaining one, if you want a vanilla Top Chef, good job. I don't know. Maybe I'm putting too
much into
it. I
mean, has she watched this show? There has been very many vanilla Top Chef winners.
Yeah, exactly. And I would also say of the group left is not very vanilla. I can understand, like, part of where she's coming from, right? I feel like the two Joes and Bruce, they all cook Italian food. But in terms of, if you're going into diversity, you have Adrian and Chris are both black, and you have Fatima, who's from Pakistan. You have, you know, all these different other types of food styles that are incorporated from these different chefs. They all have different stories, and they all have different personalities as well. I really do not feel like anyone is a boring vanilla top chef. So I don't know, maybe on behalf of the other chefs, I personally took offense to those comments. Haley, how did you feel about Claudette's final words here?
Not great.
All right. Well, Jim, can you sort of, and we'll segue into Last Chance Kitchen here, but can you sort of send off Claudette here? What, because, you know, she had this very rare position of someone who came back. She got eliminated very early on. She came back from Last Chance Kitchen, wanted to prove herself. But, you know, I think she arguably became one of the more dramatic people from the season, or at least behind some of the more dramatics. What is your thoughts overall with Claudette in her time in Colorado?
You know, I think that Claudette is really awesome. And I think that she cooks a very specific regional type of cuisine, which you can probably find the ingredients for in LA, but I'm not so sure that you can find them all the time in Chicago. So I mean, in Colorado. So I think that she was probably put a little bit behind the eight ball just because of location and her style of cooking. But at the same time, you know, like, I wish that her exit would have happened a little bit differently, but, you know, she could have been the first person in Top Chef history to hear "pack your knives" three times. It could have been a possibility. And, you know, she was like, I think I loved having her on the show. Like I say, like, I would love to hang out with Claudette and do an event with her sometime. You know, I hear she's totally awesome. I love her story. And I think that her regional style of cuisine is something that I know very little about. I'm like a lot of the other chefs on the show. Like, when she starts talking, I have to get, you know, like, go and look things up. It sounds really awesome with the food that she makes. So best of wishes to Claudette, and I enjoyed her on the show.
All right, Haley, Claudette was on your team. You want to send her off with a nice lip stained kiss?
Yeah, I'll find my brightest, most vibrant lipstick and do that. I like her a lot, and she's fiery and she's fun and she's exciting, and I from what I've seen on the internet, a lot of people aren't happy with how she was on the show.
Ooh, Twitter.
But it is reality television, like, right? You know, you want some, they cast personalities like this and throw them into these high stress situations to create television, you know, and that's what happened. And you don't have to like every single person on TV, but please don't send them rude things on the internet, because, you know, that's not exactly who they are as a human being in existence. So let's just keep it civil, friends.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am happy that Claudette came back for a number of reasons. One of them is because, as you said, you know, she doesn't really have these fiery confessionals. Love them or hate them, they're very fiery. But I like the fact that she was able to cook the food that she wanted to. I'm glad that she used her opportunity in Last Chance Kitchen to remember, okay, this is why I'm on the show, is because I cooked this great Mexican cuisine. Let me really showcase that in Last Chance Kitchen, and got her onto the show. And it sort of, you know, gave her a new sense of culinary life. Did it, you know, she got pretty far. She made it to Restaurant Wars. I honestly feel like that's nothing to sneeze at when it comes to Top Chef. It really is such a big milestone. And so I have to give her major kudos for that. It stinks that, unfortunately, the connotation behind her these past couple times deals with her really not being a team player. Because as you mentioned, Jim, I'm sure she's fantastic in the outside world. I think going back, ironically, to what Tanya said, it might just be that she doesn't work well with these types of personalities. I wasn't a fan of the way she was portrayed in this episode, and especially the way that she went out. But I will not throw any more shade towards her as we move into Last Chance Kitchen. Luck versus someone who needs a little bit of luck in Claudette, as Claudette tries to, as Jim said, become the victor or the Aussie of Top Chef. Haley, what was this week's Last Chance Kitchen challenge?
I wish I knew. I completely forgot to watch it. Until you were talking about something Brother or Claudette had said to Brother, I was like, oh, that must have been in like the, you know, American edit of the show. And I was like, oh shit, they were both in Last Chance Kitchen. I forgot. So I have no idea what happened, so you just tell me.
Sure, you'll have something to watch after the show. This was an interesting theming. The episode was called Last Chance, and Tom said, oh, Claudette, you're on your last legs here. So we're going to give you some produce that's on its last leg. So they were given, they had to make a dish, no protein. They could only use a table full of overripe and nearly spoiled produce, essentially, and create that into a dish in 30 minutes. First, I want to ask Jim. Jim, you are someone who went through Last Chance Kitchen. What is that experience like as compared to Top Chef, the main show?
You know, Last Chance Kitchen is really a lot of fun. It is really neat to work in front of Tom. Like, it's, you know, it's really a pleasure to work in front of someone who you've respected for your whole career. And this is a situation where he's actually watching the whole time because they're short. I think that he may have a little bit more control or, you know, input over what goes on in those. And so I think that it's just a lot of fun. You know, you have the gallery there cheering you on. And even though there's a lot on the line, there's less pressure, I think, because you've already been voted out before. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. you've already experienced the worst of it. So there's only potential upside, and, you know, it might feel bad again that you get sent home, but, you know, it's fun and you have a lot of space. There's not tons of people there and it's good. It's a lot of fun. I enjoy watching them.
Yeah. When we had Brooke on a couple of weeks ago, she said that, you know, much against our previous theorizing, they do film them after a person gets eliminated. How much time passed between when you got eliminated in the sudden death quick fire and then when you went to Last Chance Kitchen?
A couple of weeks. They happen in hunks. Like, I know that I listened to Brooke and she wasn't the clearest on this. But you know, like, you may, you know, as soon as there are like maybe five or six eliminated chefs, maybe you spend a day filming three Last Chance Kitchens in a row. And so they happen in hunks, and that may vary from season to season, but there were a couple of weeks. And so, you know, we're all living in the hotel. The eliminated chefs are all living together in a hotel, and really people kept pretty quiet about Last Chance Kitchen. Or you know, maybe the chefs who are still in it, your paths cross ways with the people going to Last Chance Kitchen to cook. You know, also something that is very survivor-like is sometimes the eliminated chefs get to test out challenges, especially quick fires before the chefs do it. So there's fun stuff going on when you're eliminated, and they put you to work, you know, testing out challenges. So there's a lot of cool stuff going on. But for me, there was probably 2 weeks, or maybe not 2 weeks, maybe 8 days from when I got eliminated to the first Last Chance Kitchen.
Mm-hmm. What was it like to be in the peanut gallery? I seem to remember for some reason that like Sam was very animated and very funny while sitting through all those Last Chance Kitchens.
Sam and BJ were both hilarious commentators, always in it. Great for the camera and great for the contestants, you know, competing in Last Chance Kitchen.
So Jim, talk to me about this challenge in particular. How do you think Claudette and brother ended up doing with using this nearly spoiled produce?
Yeah, I think it was cool. I mean, to me, this was one of the, I don't know, the food, they both seemed good. I mean, it's hard to, you know, look at the table, you know, there's artichokes and peppers and onions, and it would be difficult to come up with that kind of a dish, but I thought brother did a good job. And I think now that brother only has three people to beat to get back in, and I think he's got a good shot. That's a much easier than looking at a list of like 10 people to get through before you get back in the show.
Yeah, so for those of you that didn't see it, Haley Strong.
Sorry, everyone.
Brother essentially takes the entire table to make, you know, some artichoke with an eggplant puree. They both are really good, according to Tom, but Brother squeaks it out because he was able to utilize more ingredients. Brother is 3-4-3. Going off of what Jim said, Haley, what do you think the chances are looking like now for Brother running the table and coming back into the competition?
I think that could be very, very likely. We saw so much brother before he left that it's hard. It was very hard for a lot of us to accept, like, oh, this is just it for him. So I could easily see him being the one to come back.
Mm-hmm. Jim, looking towards even past brother to the remaining seven contestants. I know that last week, Kurt, Haley and I gave our own sort of winner picks at this point in the competition. Do you have any thoughts about who you think might take it, even though you talked about how wide of a field it was before?
Look, I have done my very best not to be spoiled for this season, which is hard to do for previous competitors. But, I don't know. Like, I am really rooting for Fatima. Like, I think that she is freaking incredible. I think that Chris would. I really like Chris, too. He and I come from sort of a similar. I mean, like, the food that we cook is stylistically very similar. Bruce would be awesome too. I really like, I like all of these chefs. Like, I don't want to make a winner pick. I don't want to jinx anybody. But you know, like I would love to see Fatima on the TV for much, much longer.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully we will, as we got, you know, a big super cut of what's coming up on this season. I won't say anything because there were, I feel like if you freeze frame certain parts, there were some pretty big spoilers as to who makes it where. But it seems like, you know, we might be playing some football. We might be doing, you know, someone says that something's offensive to them. A football player compares the food to slop, not from the Big Brother perspective. We have another sudden death quickfire, which I'm sure got Jim feeling a little bit of PTSD. They go to Telluride. Yeah. There's twists. We still have, you know, 6 or so episodes to watch, and there's going to be a lot there, and I'm super excited to see what happens. Do either of you have anything else you want to say about this episode, or Jim, about this season of Top Chef so far?
Yeah, I do have sort of one thing I want to say in general, and I've been following a lot of the Top Chef press, even more so than I used to, but I think that there's this real false dichotomy when people talk about a technical chef, I'm doing air quotes, a technical chef versus a soulful chef, also in air quotes. I think that to say somebody like Joe Stash is a technical chef to the detriment of him being soulful is bad. In the same way that somebody might say that Chris is a soulful chef, maybe borderline racist, but also kind of implies that he doesn't have the same technical skills, like that is a load of crap. That guy is a brilliant chef. And just because he cooks things that you may view as more down home or approachable doesn't mean that they have any less technique involved. And so I think that, you know, Kristen Kish is another great example of this. She was always called a technical chef, but then people think of her as not cooking with her soul, air quotes again. So all of these people who are on Top Chef are both, you can't be on Top Chef and not cook with your heart and your soul. And you can't be on Top Chef and not be a technical chef. You wouldn't be there. So I think there's a real false, it's a false dichotomy that maybe lends itself to a story, but I think that people who watch the show should just be careful. Like, I mean, I don't know if you noticed, but you definitely saw Chris holding a liquid nitrogen earlier and, you know, in this past episode. And I'm sure if you ask Chris, you know, like, you know, I'm sure that he, look, any chef can get a recipe and do molecular gastronomy. It's not unlike other recipes, but people just choose to based on what they like or what their restaurant is. And so to make assumptions like some people aren't as technical as others is usually just wrong. They may be more technical in other areas. So that's sort of my Top Chef media high horse. And I do think that Gail and Tom say things like, oh, this chef is really technical. They mean that as a compliment, and they don't mean to say that that chef is lacking soul. So I think that that's just something to keep in mind.
I mean, I would look no further than two of your compatriots last season, Sheldon and Shirley. Both were really complimented on the amount of motion that they put into their dishes, but they were both extremely technical where they knew what they were doing. I sort of see what you're talking about, where, you know, I don't think people would point to someone like Richard Blaze, who's very technical, as necessarily cooking with emotion. But I actually got the opportunity to talk with Gail about that when I went to the live quickfire for charity here in New York a couple months ago. And she said something very similar to what you said about how you have to cook with heart. You have to cook with emotion. You need to put yourself there on the plate. So I do agree that people that try to dissociate, you know, oh, you just put a lot of technique into this without actually putting any soul into it versus, oh, you just put a lot of soul into it without actually accentuating any technique. There's much more gray lines between the area. Haley, what do you think?
I completely agree. And I don't know. I don't have anything else to say except, yeah, totally agree with you. And shit, people need to stop and just exist. Let people cook how they want. Okay. Like, let's just back off.
Well, we can finish things off. Speaking of soulful food, I got to enjoy some very technical and very soulful food. I'll give like a little bit of an anecdote about when I went to the Goldilocks and the Three Bears dinner at the James Beard House, cooked by the Bears. First, Jim,
hilarious theme.
Yes, it was
it
incredible.
Is so
theming.
Funny.
Also, because the Goldilocks was actually, so Tyler brought in his pastry chef, Kristen Eddy, from Simsbury, Connecticut, down to cook the dessert. So I can talk about the dishes, but that was where the Goldilocks came from. But Jim, I know that you said you've cooked at the James Beard House before. For those that have not attended, can you sort of describe what it's like to cook and dine there?
The James Beard House is so amazing. I mean, you walk into this New York brownstone and you just sort of feel the history of the place. James Beard is really a, you know, someone that every chef looks up to, has an amazing career. We all have his cookbooks. We all know what he did for bringing good cuisine to America, much like Julia Child. And, you know, it's hard, like when you guests walk in the door and they walk through that tiny kitchen, it's just great to soak in all the history. You see the map on the wall and, you know, it's really an amazing place. And I've got to say too, the James Beard Foundation means a lot to me personally because I was a recipient of a James Beard scholarship to go to culinary school. And they do amazing things that are, you know, doing dinners at the Beard House is awesome. And every chef wants to do it. But the James Beard Foundation does a lot of other things that are amazing, like scholarships, and they're into food policy across the states. They have amazing sustainable fish projects. So there's a lot of things that the James Beard Foundation does that really mean a lot to chefs all across the country. And they have a special place in my heart because they did, in fact, help send me to culinary school. You know, I was also a sommelier 20 years ago at a James Beard dinner. So I have also experienced this sort of the front of the house of the James Beard experience and picking wines and pairing for a dinner. And so the James Beard House is just really amazing. And the history is so rich there. It's incredible.
Yeah, it was such, I mean, it was my first time being there, and it was such an incredible experience on a myriad of levels. First, as you mentioned, walking through that kitchen, which is so small, and I didn't even realize I would be walking to the kitchen, so I just, like, walk through it. I say, oh, look, there's Joe, just sort of chatting with somebody. There's Bruce, you know, sweating the night away. And then they actually see and dine you sort of in an area that's made up to look like, you know, James Beard's living room. You know, there's a bookshelves full of cookbooks, which actually, so I got the opportunity, I got to sit next to Tyler's fiance and one of his best friends. And so we gabbed the night away, and we tried to play a game where we were trying to, like, figure out what all the cookbooks were that were on the shelf. Of course, the more we drank, the harder task that became, but it was so much fun. So as I mentioned before, Adrian was there. Adrian got to, she didn't cook, but she got to sit down. She was looking lovely. Melissa, the first contestant eliminated from this season, actually helped cook. I know Bruce brought in a couple people as well. And the food, it was a fantastic experience. I don't want to, like, humble brag too much, but it might be one of the best overall meals I've had in my life. Just to read down some of the stuff that we had, you know, we had a little bit of, like, a cocktail hour, and they brought around some oysters with the sherry maple cream that I mentioned before, some porchetta. They had a nice arancini with a truffle aioli that was delicious. And then, and true with that Three Bears theming, the first course that we had was three porridges. One was too hot, one was too cold, and one was just right. The one that was just right, Tyler made it. It was one with black truffle. I'm not a food critic for a reason. I can't describe food, but it was just immaculate. And then Tyler made this really interesting pollock in a cabbage juice with some smoked foie gras, and he came up with this interesting technique where he had this sort of, like, sweet potato sauce that was made up of, like, scrapings from the grill. It sounded like it had this really interesting taste to it that we were trying to figure out, and it turned out it was just a bunch of tastes mixed together. But my favorite course might go to the third one we had, which was Joe Flam. He made a ricotta beet consanse, which was essentially like a little dumpling with some beet and ricotta inside it. But he also made a sauce out of the whey of the ricotta with some beets. And it was just, it was incredible. Bruce made some short rib that was so tender with some horseradish and a butter poached salsify. And then for dessert, we had, you know, a little bit of a platter to pass around, but we had some chocolate cake with nougat, strawberry jam, and a nice malt crunch. Then they came up at the end, and, you know, they did some Q&A. They talked a little bit about how they all came together and, you know, how much they liked each other. They, of course, they were, you know, very snarky, as the Bears usually were. I was happy to see Tyler back. I missed some snarky Tyler confessionals, especially in this episode. So it was good to see him sort of gabbing about these things. They are also very big in true Bear fashion, much taller than you could actually imagine, but yeah, I mean, I was so grateful for the experience that to get to see these guys live in person, especially so because Bruce and Joe did so, so well in this Restaurant Wars, and wishing the best for them moving forward. We'll see if a bear, a fox, or another woodland creature ends up taking it home. With that, I think we should start finishing things off. First off, Jim, I want to thank you profusely for coming on and talking about this. This was so great to hear from you, not only as a fan of the show or a fan of RHAP, but to give your restaurant experience, to give your alumni experience. It was truly a pleasure to have you on.
Well, hey, it was a pleasure to be here. And, you know, like Kat said, you know, no one wants to date someone who doesn't make the merge. So I appreciate you all inviting me, despite the fact that I was not in Restaurant Wars.
Wow.
Really, it's a total pleasure.
Yeah. Well, Jim, hopefully you didn't get any work done like Kat Ederson did with Hayden by the time the Blood versus Water reunion came around. Wow. I would not have expected a Kat Ederson reference. I love this. Well, Jim, how can people follow you on social media? I know you said you live tweet Top Chef, and you mentioned some stuff coming up. Is there anything you want to promote in particular?
Yeah, you know, please follow, friend, like me. I have two Facebook pages like most idiots, but I have a fan and a regular page. Like, I do much more stuff on the regular page, but if you just search for Chef Jim Smith, I come up on every profile, every social media platform first or very near the top. Almost Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, follow me, friend me, like me. I also have a great webpage. It's chefjimsmith.com, which you can also link up to all of my social media there. And I also would like to plug the Alabama Seafood Marketing Commission website, which is eatalabamaseafood.com. There's lots of great recipes, and you can find where to buy Alabama seafood in your area. And yeah, those are sort of what I'm into online, and, you know, please reach out and support me. So like I said, I do have this great, we're doing the Meals on Wheels charity in Delaware coming up. That's the event that I'm doing with Bruce and Carrie and John. And I think Katsuji will be there. I think there's, that's a big event I have coming up that I'd love to invite anybody to come out to. It's a wonderful event, a great charity. So yeah, look me up on social media, please. I need more followers. so please.
Perfect. Haley, how can people follow you on social media? And how has The Bachelor been going so far? I know you talked about it last week. Has it gotten any more exciting for you?
No, it hasn't. Jim, I'm sure you would probably agree with me that Ari has not been the most dynamic lead we've ever had. But if you follow the wrap up speed, you'll get our podcast up in there. If not, then just search my name or The Bachelor in your iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use. You'll find it. We have a great little red logo. On Instagram and Twitter, I'm at @hstrong_, and I'm not going to give you my home address because I don't want you to stalk me.
All right, good. You stopped one degree from a pure stalkage. You can follow me on Twitter at @amikebloomtype. Check out all the podcasts and interviews that I'm doing. As I said, I just posted my exit interview with Tanya from this past week. I have not heard back from Claudette 2.0 yet, but I'm sure it'll be interesting to get her perspective on how things shook down with Restaurant Wars and overall what she thought about the Top Chef experience. So be sure to check that out. I also cover The Amazing Race. I just revamped RuPaul's Drag Race podcast. That premiere came out a couple days ago, and I got together with Brent Wolgamott and Liana Boris to talk about that.
I am very, very excited about that podcast.
It was a really fun time, so I'm excited for everyone to hear it. So moving forward with some Top Chef stuff, just a couple of quick items. First, in terms of actual airing, usually Top Chef airs, you know, at 10 o'clock, but because it aired a little bit later because of the finale of the show that happened before it, Top Chef is now moved back to 9 o'clock. So all you Top Chef fans out there, remember to, if you need to change your DVRs or just remember that if you're watching live, Top Chef now airs an hour earlier from 9 p.m. in perpetuity for the rest of the season. So an hour earlier to check out all the great stuff going on this season. Something else I want to mention, you can follow the great host Kurt Clark at Kurt Clark. He unfortunately was not able to make it. And unfortunately, due to scheduling difficulties, Kurt will not be able to join us for podcasts for the rest of the season. But he has been so much fun to have on this season. We're so lucky that we got to talk with him for the episodes that we did. We've got some stuff cooking up. We've got some stuff simmering on the boiler of people to possibly bring in and talk more Top Chef with. Haley and I will not be going anywhere anytime soon, but if you guys would, you could always reach out to Kurt and let him know how much you've enjoyed him on the podcast and how much you love vanilla Top Chefs, because he loves them probably most of all. To finish things off, We got to give a hashtag. I was thinking asbestos hands. I don't know if you guys had any in mind.
I am in.
That works for me.
All right. So just because now the gym has sort of put that term out for us non-chefs, let's go with asbestos hands. Hopefully you guys are not grabbing any hot plates anytime soon.
Or asbestos. Don't grab any asbestos either.
Yeah, that's a good. Yeah, that's probably some good advice as well. But Jim, I wanted to thank you so much again for coming on to talk about Restaurant Wars. This was so much fun. Haley, great stuff as usual. We'll be back next week as Top Chef segues out of Restaurant Wars and furthers its journey throughout Colorado. But for now, you may pack your knives and go.